Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here as we're approaching the end of January 2020. Just coming off a remarkable stretch of cold weather here in Sitka and I think all over Southeast Alaska. Temperatures warmed up a little bit faster than originally forecast with above freezing temperatures here in Sitka by Saturday. If it had remained below, as the forecast called for, I think Saturday was supposed to only get up to about 25, and that would have, I think, put this streak of cold weather maybe only a couple of days short of the longest stretch. There's a website where you can look at consecutive streaks, and I was kind of curious about those, and it turns out the longest stretch of freezing weather in Sitka is only 15 days with temperatures below freezing. That's at the airport. I'm sure it's a little longer if we looked at the inland stations. But yeah, we'll probably talk a little bit more about the weather. But I do want to introduce my guest for this week. I have Kitty LaBounty here, a frequent guest, has come to join me, and we're recording this live on Saturday before the show airs. And so, welcome, Kitty.
Thank you.
Yes, you got to experience some of the cold weather effects at your place with mechanicals.
Yes, actually, I was pretty lucky in the way my house behaved. I was able to keep all my pipes happy and all that sort of stuff through some use of multiple different ways of heating the house. No heat tape, though, actually, and some skirting that had been put in around the house. So the house was fine. The skiff, however, the steering was not overly happy with me, and it froze. So I need to work on that in a more permanent way, other than just waiting for the weather to warm up so the steering works again. So I have wonderful neighbors and was able to travel with them.
Yeah, it's not like you can just walk to work when your vehicle isn't working.
No, and it's not, I have kayak and all that, but I was like, in that kind of cold temperatures and all that, I was not inspired to be kayaking back and forth to work. So yes, I was thankful I had neighbors and that I can do actually quite a bit of work from home.
The internet makes things a little telecommuting a little more easy.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Well, it has been, I was kind of curious because the last time it got this cold, I think, was 2012, and it actually got colder that year, but it was only for about 3 days. There was a day that got down to 5. I think in the end, I don't think the official temperatures this stretch ever got into single digits, although the forecast was for it to get that cold. And it was certainly that cold at my house. I took a little thermometer out and was curious just to see how cold things were. And interestingly, I expected it would be coldest right on the ground, but I found that it was actually a little colder about 3 feet off the ground for some reason. I'm not sure why. Maybe heat. There's enough heat stored in the ground that it's keeping
it was still radiating.
Yeah, at some level. I mean, it's weird to think of it radiating when it's only like 5 degrees, but yeah, I mean, in the end, that's probably what it's doing. But it was down to around 1 degree or something at my house. The coldest times I was kind of between 0 and 1 on that thermometer.
It was kind of interesting, the difference between island temperature or just the way it felt and town. So it wasn't exactly warm out on the island, but it wasn't windy, so we weren't having those problems earlier. But it was cold. I had all my regular like Fairbanks sort of gear on, basically my big old down parka. I had on, you know, long underwear, lined pants, yada yada, all the stuff. And I was fine actually. It was actually pretty comfortable being outside and even just hanging out, standing around outside. But when I got into town, usually it was like, oh my gosh, it felt colder.
Yeah.
I mean, it was still okay and everything, but there was a distinct difference. So even that little bit of change from, you know, the smaller islands near town surrounded by water to actually town proper was distinct.
Well, Wednesday, I measured the temperature. I had a class at the university that started at 8 in the morning. So I measured the temperature at my house before I left, and I think it was 5 or 8 or somewhere, 7, somewhere in that. It was definitely single digits. And then 15 minutes later at the university, measuring it basically the same way, it was 17, I think. So it was almost 10 degrees warmer. Now, there was a breeze at the university at the time, so I could see, it wasn't a strong breeze, but I could see the wind turbine at the Coast Guard base turning. And so I suspect that that helps to mix the air down so that inversions don't form so much. And that probably helps keep things warmer. But it is, it's making me curious again. I know that, for a long time, the weather record was at Geodetic Way. And they actually still, there is a station there that's automated now that does this. I think there was that long period where it was all manual and so forth, I think ended in the mid or late 80s. And then the airport started up in the 40s, probably World War II when the naval base went in there, and it's been continuous since then. And that's been the primary one for at least 20 or 30 years now. So that's where, if you're looking at the forecast or you're looking at the temperature records, it's from the airport, which is significantly warmer. It's not, maybe not quite as warm as the island. I don't know.
It's pretty similar.
Pretty similar to what you're seeing out on Glenkin, which makes some sense. I mean, it's a little closer to town, I guess, but... It is substantially warmer. I suppose folks that, you know, in the summertime, it's a different effect. In the summertime, it's probably warmer in town than it is
definitely
out on the island.
Yep. And, it's not a huge difference, but it is both. It's like a little microcosm of that coastal water effect, that moderating influence of the water. And it's just interesting how much that comes through, even on these little micro scales, really.
Yeah, and you definitely see it if you drive out to Stargaven, for example, where it's, despite still being on the water, I have more than one occasion gone out there and go, whoa, where did all this snow come from? Because it had been raining in town, and there's just enough cooler out there to fall is snow. So that is it. It'll be interesting once they get the road into Catlin and you can get out there a little more easily. I suspect it's even colder in Catlin, despite, you know, the bays there, but it's back one more ridge off of the main body of the sound. So a little micro effects. And of course, just going across the island or going 100 miles north or, you know, Juneau was having winds, Taku winds, I think, where some of the peak gusts were over 100 miles an hour, which sounds a little
nasty.
Yeah, nasty. I think it was that one of the weather the weather forecast, if you read the text synopsis for Southeast Alaska, it's usually just, you know, weather speak and stuff, but one of the recent ones was talking about the bumping and moaning and all of the noises that were happening all night from the Taku winds just buffeting the house and the lack of sleep that engendered and the need for caffeine in the morning. And so it was a little less formal than it often is, just acknowledging that it was some pretty fierce winds, blowing there in Juneau area. And I think Haines also had a
definitely
pretty big bout of that.
There was some question about whether or not the ferry would be running between Haines and Juneau. And I do know for a fact that it was at least running yesterday.
Yeah. The Lynn Canal can get a little bit, little bit fierce than these outflow events.
Yes.
And that was one thing that was interesting about this one here is it wasn't that windy from, as you mentioned, you know, most of the time it seems like when we get weather like this, it is windy here in town.
Well, the two pressure centers, I've been started teaching again. And this semester I teach a natural history of Alaska class. And the first thing we talk about is climate and weather. So I've been looking at a lot of the weather maps that are produced. It's actually, there's a better name for it, but I always find it by like Googling Alaska television weather, which is, there's definitely a better way, but that works. So I'm sticking with it. But you get these beautiful weather maps, with, you know, the highs and lows all marked and with the, you know, the pressure associated with each, and the pressure differences were not very big between the highs and the lows, and that really drives the wind. Right now, there's a much bigger difference, and the isobars are much tighter together, so the wind, which reflects that wind difference.
Yeah,
so it's kind of cool.
Yeah, it is. It is, and in this case, that cold, it was, I guess, for the better part of a month, maybe longer, December and the first part of January, the interior and western Alaska was super cold. I think Bethel didn't get above 0 degrees for a month or something like that. And Fairbanks was, what, minus 40, minus 50?
Minus 40, minus 30. Not right in Fairbanks, but not up in the interior. I think they hit minus 60. Mm-hmm. That's still not the record.
No, but it's
getting down.
It's as cold as it's been in a while.
Yes.
And that pool of cold air moved to the southeast. So Yukon got it. And that's when it showed up in Southeast Alaska. It was still colder in Fairbanks, but it was much warmer in Fairbanks than it had been. And much colder here.
Fairbanks warmed up for a little while, and now it's cold again. So we have something to look forward to.
If it moves this direction, yeah, it will be a little sloppy, I'm sure, in the coming week as it's supposed to warm up and the packed snow turns to ice. Because that was, I guess, the other thing is right before this, we had 18 inches of snow on the ground over 3 or 4 days. That it was interesting how fast it started to, because even overnight, I measured it when I went to bed one night. It was 18 inches out in my yard. And the next morning it was 17.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the snow. I was curious enough about it that I read about it a little bit. And my initial thought was, oh, it's just compacting because it's under its own weight. But it's actually reforming as well. So the crystals are slow, like the pointy bits start to round out.
Mini glaciation.
Yes, and it happens. And this is, it actually reminded me, I'd read about this before. If you're into avalanche and snow country travel and want to know about avalanches, this is important information that you learn about because it affects the depth. And then that's often where those avalanches, especially the worst ones, initiate because there's a big snow load. And then when all that cuts loose, so the nature of the snow grains and so forth and what happens to them as they evolve from their initial fluffy falling and start to compact and change over time. It's fascinating. People, I'm sure, have dedicated whole careers to that. It's a lot of interesting stuff out there for folks that are interesting. No end of questions, I'm sure.
So what was kind of fun about the snow, and I haven't been able to do this for a while because we haven't had a lot of snow, is so you notice for a while it was all this, you know, lovely, clean, white snow, and then we had a lot of wind that hit, and the snow was like a debris field, basically. Lots of stuff blowing out of the trees and little branches and things like that. One of the things that's kind of cool to look at, if this is the nerdiest thing maybe I'm going to say today, I don't know. It's still early. But if you look at some of that debris, even small bits of it, you know, and collect some of it in a dish, you can see all sorts of cool little tiny things. So there's little bits of lichens, there's little bits of mosses. Which is kind of cool. That's how a lot of those things reproduce, is by breaking up or fragmenting into little pieces. And the snow, first, that kind of shears things off, and then the wind that distributes them, is a great way for all these small, tiny things to get around. Who needs legs? Who needs wings? Making use of the wind. So it's kind of cool. And you can see some of these little bits and pieces on the snow. If you have a hand lens or
I was scope. Out today and just noticing, I was walking up Indian River Trail, and I actually just took a picture of the surface because I was like, there's a lot of stuff here. And it basically has fallen over a week. And some of that, I mean, it was windy last night and it was gusty today. So some of it was falling then. But I think that's just the stuff that probably, you know, needles are falling, cones are falling, the seeds in the dry weather, the seeds are definitely coming out.
Oh, their seeds are all over the place.
And I was like, oh, you don't really, because you just see the forest floor and it's all mossy, and you don't really think about how much stuff is just constantly accumulating. So having that clean surface to go, oh, wow. I mean, just in a week, there's all this stuff that's fallen down here. And that's happening all the time, but I'm not necessarily seeing it.
Yeah, it was kind of fun with all the seeds. So the first thing I noticed, even before the big wind, you do see all those seeds start popping out, because both the conifer cones and then the alder catkins start opening up in that dry cold weather, and so the snow has a lot of small seeds. So there's ones with little wings that looks like little wings on them that are the spruce seeds, and then we also have a lot of little alder seeds which don't have that big sort of wing. But I did start noticing that the birds were like working the roof of my house, because there was this nice little snow field up there with all these little seeds on the top. So they were spending a lot of time up there as well as at the feeder.
Well, that was one thing I was noticing, is that there were a lot of seeds, and weren't, like at Stargavin, for example, there were a lot of seeds, especially in the little hollows, but there weren't that many birds kind of working on them. And I, you know, it was so cold that it did seem like that was definitely affecting their behavior a little bit.
It definitely changed. I had a lot more birds around when it was just snow, and then the birds got a little bit quieter when it started getting really cold. It was like they were still around, but they were like hiding under the rhododendron more, hiding under little bits of shrubbery, or they could sneak underneath the boardwalk a little bit and they would be under there. So I think they were finding any shelter they could get. They'd come out and grab some seeds and then duck back in.
Yeah, I noticed the first couple of days seemed like a lot of juncos and stuff around, and then by the last three, it's like, did they all just give up and fly south, or did we have a significant mortality event, or, you know, know, it'll be interesting to see throughout the rest of the winter whether or not it starts to seem like normal numbers again. Certainly there's been plenty of varied thrushes around, continuing to be. But it was the sparrows that I noticed, the juncos, and juncos in particular, I guess, mm-hmm. which are often quite abundant, that were just like I wasn't seeing them as much for some reason.
The numbers definitely dropped off, but just to, like maybe it was yesterday or the mm-hmm. day before, I saw a bunch of them again. So yeah. I was like, oh, okay, you're still around.
Could just be a timing thing as well. That's
But it was interesting. Their behavior definitely changed. It seems like they were, you know, they were just like, hang out on the food when it was just snow and it wasn't really that cold. But as soon as that temperature started really dipping below 20, they were like, let's, you know, save a little bit of our oomph. And I actually moved where I was feeding them when the wind started, because the wind's like when it was howling around the corner of my house. And if I moved the feed a little bit downhill so they didn't have to stand in the wind to get it. They may have not cared at all, but it just felt nicer to me.
Yeah, I think they do, at least small birds, you know, they do seem to like to choose the less windy locations. Yeah, this and the extent of this, you know, I mentioned earlier that it got a little colder in 2012, but didn't last for as long. But I think the last time we had a stretch of 6 days where, I mean, the highest temperature got, I think, from Sunday through Friday, I'm pretty sure was the highest temperature was 25 officially. I think the last time it was colder, that cold for longer was maybe in the early 80s, but it might have been in the late 70s.
I thought you said something about a 1970s year when we talked about this the last time.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's been over 40 years, I think, or close to 40 years, around 40 years since the last time we had a stretch quite this long. And weather is what it is. It's kind of weird and random. Sometimes you get these things that set up. So it's been... Yeah, it was amazing today to go out, and it was warmer than expected. So today being Saturday, as we're recording this, and the temperature was already up to 30 this morning. It had actually warmed overnight instead of cooling like it was supposed to. And it was like, wow, this feels warm. And and knowing in my head, if this had happened 3 weeks ago and we're coming off of a very warm December, kind of November-December period was quite warm, relatively speaking. And then to have 30 degrees and it would have felt chilly and cold, but coming out of 17, 18 degrees. It's like,
it's
this is nice.
Hot now.
Yeah. So it's funny how the perception, you know, where you're coming from sort of shifts things.
I definitely have noticed that when I'm up north, when it dips down to like minus 25 for a couple of days and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is pretty serious. And it gets up to like 17. It's like, hey, it's warm. Let's go skiing. It's what you get used to. And, having the right clothes is like everything. And I'm just lucky because my kids live up in Fairbanks. So I have the right clothes for colder. So what we had was manageable, at least for me, for staying warm personally.
Yeah, it is a lot of what you're used to. I had enough. I had to dig out some layers that I haven't used in a while. But definitely, it was nice to get out. It's nice to see. I was glad it wasn't windy. I think it would have been a lot tougher if it had just been one of those.
I've been hiding.
Yeah. 2011, we had a cold snap. I don't think it got quite as cold and it didn't last as long, but it killed all, like that year, the salmonberry thickets were just dead. So many of them in that. And I think it was the cold wind. And I remember walking downtown to a talk at the library, I think. And my brother and I were walking down and during that. And it was just like, frigid. It felt so cold, the snow was blowing off the mountain peaks, and there, even up high, it didn't look like there was you didn't see a lot of snow blowing off those peaks, but it was so uncomfortable. But yeah, without the wind,
it was
pleasant.
Was very grateful for not having the wind. It made it like very doable. Once the wind started, even today, actually just going out in the wind, at times it felt colder because it was just kind of blasting you. And I still pulled my little face gaiter up over my mouth and nose because it's just more comfortable to breathe air that's warm.
Yes, yeah, for sure. And before we leave the topic of the cold, there's one other thing I wanted to just mention is the red-breasted sapsuckers. Several people have made note of them. You don't usually see them much in the winter. And it's been a while since we've had a cold snap. It turns out over the last 15 years or so that I've been paying attention, During a cold snap like this, it's not unusual to see red-breasted sapsuckers, usually at nice sun-exposed locations right on the shore or pretty close to it. And then it seems like as the temperature warms up, they start to and when you see them when it's really cold, they're not very active. They're just kind of just lethargically tapping away at the base of a spruce tree or something. And then as it warms up, they seem to get a little more active and you start to see them a little more around, and then they go away again. And my sense is that they're spending the winters at middle elevations, which is a bit unusual because I don't really see them at middle elevations during the nesting season. So it's almost like these birds are moving uphill for the winter and coming downhill for the summer. Now, I don't think there's as many around as there are in the summer. I think that there are definitely some that move south. But it seems like there are a fair number that will stay the winter but move uphill, which is, you know, like I say, counterintuitive for migrating bird. And I have a theory about it that it has to do with the theory arose when I happened to read about maple syruping, and you need freezing at night, thawing in the day temperatures for the sap to really run. If you don't have that, and it's a physical thing, it's not the plant isn't really doing it as much as it is the freezing and thawing creates some sort of fluid pressure that drives the sap. And so if that's happening, then there's no reason to think that it isn't happening like spruce trees or something like that, perhaps. And so maybe that's why these birds are staying closer to that freeze-thaw line throughout the winter.
Easier to get food.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. That's my hypothesis. I guess there would be ways to test that. But I probably
would be fun.
Won't. Yeah. It would be, I suppose there's ways to, with some iBed and remote things, we could figure out what the
start tapping trees
do, and then tapping spruce trees. Right. So that would be interesting. I don't know that I'll get around to it, but if somebody does, I'd be very curious what they find out. So, that was another thing. I know folks had been seeing sapsuckers around and a little curious about those.
So speaking of birds and seeing them, keep looking for juncos mm-hmm. with bling, so to speak. Juncos with bracelets, still trying to keep track of our banded birds for our project. We banded some more this year, so they're out there. And if you see any, you can let Matt know, or you can let me know. Either way.
Yeah, if you see any, feel free to. If it's best if you can get a picture, but if
totally
even if you
best.
Can't, it's good to know that you're seeing them, and better than just knowing that you're seeing them is knowing what colors of bands right. on which legs. So they could have as many as two bands per leg. One of the bands they have will always be aluminum colored, kind mm-hmm. of a silver color, and then the other ones are going to be various colors of plastic.
Right.
It can be difficult, especially in cold weather when they're all hunched down, to actually see the legs. And it's the bird's right and left, so you gotta account for that as well. But if you can tell us what those colors are, then we can tell you where that bird was banded and when. And that is, an ongoing project, which I think that was our ninth year.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke with
yes.
Gwen, so maybe we'll right. do an even and 10. I don't know.
That's how my brain works, but... The more the merrier, I figure. The more birds we have banded, the more birds. Someday, another one of those birds is going to show up in a crazy place and someone's going to catch it. And that is probably just a numbers game. Get more birds out there with bands. Hopefully one will get found. We found one showed up in Juneau. So I'm just crossing my fingers.
We've had two or three different reports that suggest ones that are nesting here, mm-hmm. also wintering here. So, yeah, that's something. Feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com. And you can, even if you're seeing other things that you're interested in, I'm happy to hear about those too. You can also get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there and send me messages through Facebook. Either way works for me. So, yeah, that's a good reminder. And I know you also like to promote the Great Backyard Bird Count. We had a good year for the Christmas Bird Count.
Mm-hmm.
I think we ended up with over 80 species for count week.
That's a lot of species.
70 some for count day, which mm-hmm. is definitely on the high side. I don't know how it compares with the rest of the state for those folks that might be a little competitive, but probably usually Sitka's in the top.
I think we did okay. Yeah, the north half has problems just
right.
with species. Their birds just leave. You know, they have big efforts and a lot of people out there. I looked at the Fairbanks report and, you know, they were well coordinated, but they only have so much daylight and a lot of their birds just like. get out of Dodge. So yeah, their numbers are going to be low.
The reality is the competition is with South Coastal Alaska. Ketchikan often has a pretty good number. Juneau often has a pretty good number. But they have
Gustavus sometimes.
Yeah, and Juneau has two count circles. So they're sort of, it's big enough road system there that some of their better places, I guess, are split up. If you combine both, they'd have more numbers. But
the Great Backyard Bird Count, and I wish I had checked the dates. It's
Precedence
like,
Day weekends, usually.
Is it that late?
That's when it usually is. Anyway, it's that four-day weekend.
It's sometime around February. It's in February. Matt's going to check it out for me. But it's kind of a fun, it's a four-day count thing. And you can count wherever. If I remember right, usually they want you to count for at least 15 minutes. But you can count in a bunch of places. You can count 4 days, all 4 days. You can count one of the days. Doesn't matter. But it is kind of another excuse to get outside and look at birds and keep track of them.
Yeah, the Great Backyard Bird Count is February 15th to 18th. And I think all you have to do is use eBird. I don't think you even have to do anything special to sign up anymore.
They actually have a really good website usually. So if you just, again, Google is my friend, Great Backyard Bird Count, you'll find the website. And there's lots of good instructions and even how to sign up for eBird if you don't have an eBird account already.
Yeah, it's been going on for quite a while. The 15th to the 18th of February. So I guess that's a little less than a month away, maybe 4 weeks away, roughly. So for folks that are interested in having an excuse, not that you need much of an excuse,
right?
But if you're interested in having an excuse, and I have to admit, when I've participated in it, I get a little competitive, and I'm like, oh, I got to go find the thing so we up our
species
count. That's right.
So we get a bigger species count than somebody else. We have done that before. It's kind of entertaining.
Yeah, it's a good reason to get out. But I've been a little busier in recent years, and have declined to trigger my compulsiveness that way. Because I definitely have that compulsive streak about such things. So it is a good opportunity for folks. And yeah, maybe I'll see if I can get my son to do a bird walk during that weekend.
Yeah, I actually think it's a pretty fun opportunity for folks. And the data is used in the same way the Christmas bird count is. It's, you know, it's another time for census period just to kind of get an idea where the birds are. And it's not, you know, it's not a rigorous scientific research project, but it's the data still shows trends and shows where birds are being seen. So we should do our bet because it's A, it's fun to go outside and look at birds. B, someone can use our data, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's true on both counts. And it is, you know, those trends and so forth. And they have all sorts of statistical methods for trying to account for some of the vagaries of citizen science and so forth.
And yeah, and just gotten effort rather sophisticated, and all that. Yeah.
Sophisticated at that. And it is, it's, you know, that's kind of a Christmas bird count. There's still some stragglers around, you know, you get birds that are probably not going to make it through the winter,
right,
especially on an earlier count. We tend to have a later count date, but February is pretty squarely in winter.
It's winter.
if the birds made it so far, it's probably going to do all right. And that actually reminds me, it'll be interesting to see this cold snap is the coldest, like I say, it's coldest we had in a while. And since the Anna's hummingbird started being consistently year-round. So I'll be interested to see if folks are still seeing those. I suspect there will be at least a few survive, but it wouldn't surprise me if there was some mortality from this from the cold that we had this past week for the Anna's hummingbirds. Because they, I remember when they were first starting to show up, we were seeing them every fall. And then in milder winters, they would make it through the winter. In a colder winter, they would disappear midwinter or thereabouts. And so That was another question that's outstanding for me, I guess, that will probably be answered in the next couple of weeks. So no end of questions. And this is only my second show of 2020. So we're just barely out of 2019 yet and haven't actually had a chance to sit down and chat with somebody about the highlights of 2019. And I had originally intended to do some things a little differently, but ended up using a couple of past shows to remember Nels and Richard Nelson and Marge Ward, both folks who were influential, I guess I would say, in my natural history journey. Of course, Richard being very encouraging and enthusiastic about all things nature with Encounters program and various things like that, and Marge being a really significant mentor, I guess I'll say, when it comes to birds in Sitka, and keeping records and really just sort of passing on that knowledge to others. So it was nice to have a chance to remember them a little bit with those shows. But as a result, it didn't really talk so much about what happened in 2019 yet. So maybe take this opportunity. Do you have any highlights that really stand out for you about your 2019 natural history year?
The one of the biggest highlights for me was actually getting to see the Kobuk Dunes, which I probably already mentioned on the show, but that was like huge for me. It was a place I had read about in for years. I started in Kotzebue when we went to see there, and then flew for roughly an hour east to get to the dunes, and they're left over from the last ice age, and it's sand material that was wind blown and accumulated in these dunes that are still there, and it's just the most amazing sight I have ever seen. And we were happened to be there on beautiful sunny weather. It was gorgeous. Bugs weren't bad. The flowers were cool. I mean, it was good stuff. So that was probably, I also enjoyed getting to see Kotzebue and visiting there. Got to stay at a fish camp at Kotzebue for a few days. And it was just, I really like the Arctic tundra. I find it pretty fascinating. And it, you know, it's like I'm not ready to move there, but I do like the contrast. To me, it's super interesting to compare, you know, the world above the Arctic Circle to Sitka.
Yeah. Well, Lynn Barber, who is a bigger birder in various places, I guess she likes to have a project to work on. And I think it was 2018 that she had a project of, she flew to Nome several times over the course of the year. She'd done a big year in Alaska the year before and then really was interested in Nome and just thought, you know, she went there and looked at birds, but other things, but she was very much focused on birds, I think. But, and that was part of it. It's just like, oh, what's going on here in this place? You know, that I don't get to spend so much time. It's very different. And we, you know, folks go to a place like that to see birds or to see a particular thing.
Right.
But
I think there, I went there to see the ecosystem or this kind of very special and unique spot in Alaska. So I didn't go there just for the birds or just for the plants, or it was the whole package was kind of interesting to me. So yeah, I recommend that trip to anybody.
Like it's a little bit of a logistical challenge to get there.
It is. You need to get yourself to Kotzebue, which isn't too hard with Alaska Airlines. And then we used a great flight service that took us out there, and it's a national monument, if I remember right. So it's not a national park, but it's in that sort of category. I should know.
It's got some protected lands.
It does. Yeah. And actually, apparently we were like the 30th group that they had brought out there that year, and you could see no signs. So people were doing an incredibly great job of picking up after themselves. I was really impressed.
I imagine the wind helps.
The wind helps, but still, I mean, we were around enough. Yeah, it wasn't, but no, there's no sign of like, there's, you know, not camp garbage or anything like that. So I was actually pretty impressed. But it was kind of cool, the different animals, tracks we saw moving through the dunes. And there is kind of a few unique plants that are there. And the bird that I see no matter where I go in Alaska was still there. The wonderful semi-palmated plover, my buddy, was there. So I kind of enjoy that. I have never been to a place in Alaska without that bird. And I'm going to be very sad if I find one without it, because they're just...
Are they in Fairbanks too?
I've seen them in Fairbanks. I've seen them in Utqiagvik. I've seen them in Bethel. I've seen them in Nome. You name it. They're around. They're great. They should be our state bird. Sorry. Maybe they're my state bird.
Yeah, you might get some pushback on that, but
I think I'd probably get a lot of pushback. Yeah. But they're a wonderful little bird.
One of your favorites.
Yes.
Yes. Well, yeah, for me, I think I remember when we had that remarkable stretch of warm weather in June, 3 weeks essentially without rain. Which was quite a while for us, for sure. Fortunately, definitely smoky skies, but we didn't have the smoke down of what we were breathing. I know that Juneau had more hotter temperatures and more smoke. That was pretty unpleasant for folks. And so That was. I guess it was fun to get out and have that nice weather to get out and enjoy the summer in. So that was, I don't know if it's a highlight, but just something I'm remembering mm-hmm. from 2019. And then also I made it up on Bear Mountain. And I think I didn't get up on Bear Mountain in 2018 in the fall, but looking at the pictures I took of it, there was still some snow up there in places that there was no snow this year. Mm-mm. I think just the combination of a variety of you know, a number of winters with warmer winters and when it was cold, it was dry, so there wasn't any real accumulation, and then having the warm summer. I think there was parts of some rock exposed on Bear Mountain, probably the first time in hundreds of years at least, right. And maybe longer than that, which was interesting to see and interesting to think, because it's not that far. You know, the peak is just right above you there, and to see the glacial striations on that rock that, you know, it's not like – it was just interesting to consider, like, how – much snow accumulated there to make that ice, even though there was not a lot of distance for it to accumulate. It was just coming mm-hmm. right down there and stacking up. So definitely, you know, piqued my curiosity a bit, and that was helped by visiting scientists Jason Briner and Caleb, who I spoke to for the show. I know you had a chance to meet as well, and the work that they're doing on looking at the glacial history around here. And Caleb actually shared a little class project thing he did, which is a really simple model of glaciers on Baranoff Island. And one of the things that was kind of I was amused by it. I think he just did it for fun, was to say, okay, the big glacier that would have come down through town from Indian River Valley, like, mm-hmm. what would it take for that to reform again? And so, you know, he said, basically, his model suggests you'd have to draw the equilibrium line to sea level. And the equilibrium line is essentially where the snow doesn't, you know, it's just where the right. snow, that line is. Above that line, there's still snow from the prior winter. Below it, there isn't.
Keeps accumulating.
Yeah. And so you'd have to drop that to zero, and it would take something like 1,000 years to form a glacier that pushed out to Sitka or something, or maybe it was 2,000. I don't remember. But it was a long time in any case. So it was interesting to see those models. I'm looking forward to, it sounds like they're going to be doing some mm-hmm. more work here and maybe trying to do a public presentation kind of thing at some point in the next couple of years. So that's something that has fascinated me. And with modern computer technology and the ability to create visualizations, I think it'll be interesting to see just like visualizations of ice mm-hmm. on Baranoff Island, you know, expanding and retreating. So,
well, I just got I'm subscribed to the NASA Earth Observatory image of the day, and one of the most recent images was about the 2019 year temperature mm-hmm. regime, and it was the second hottest year on record. The hottest was 2016, but if you look at the increase above normal, it's nicely color coded, so parts of the globe where it was normal get redder. So most of the red was concentrated in Alaska and in northern regions, which, I mean, we already know they knocked out weather records in Anchorage and in that whole area. And I don't think we broke any records in Sitka, but it was a long period of warm weather.
Yeah, it was warm. Definitely Alaska was Alaska
hot.
Was much warmer than normal. I think that I don't know how they average for the whole state because it's a lot of area, but they
it's
said something
huge,
like
yeah.
6 degrees above normal or something for the state.
Right. And there are individual maps that the Alaska Climate Research Center mm-hmm. puts together that you can see regionally.
Yeah.
You know,
and it does
different
vary
temperature.
Quite a bit by region.
Definitely.
Southeast. Sitka had during that warm stretch of sunny, dry weather in June, Sitka had a marine layer push in the mm-hmm. morning. It started pushing in, and then that really moderated things. So our highs ended up being in the 60s. Juneau's in the 80s. Some of those days, I think, are pushing 80.
Right.
The other interesting thing was that for this, you know, 2 years ago, 2018, we were 20 inches below normal precipitation,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, happens sometimes. But this past year, we were, for a good chunk of it, we were actually even behind the pace of the prior year. But
in the drought.
Yes. A very wet drought, but a drought, officially a drought nonetheless. And the fall, though, we caught up and surpassed. We ended up having I don't know that it was hugely wetter than normal.
But it was soggy.
It was enough wetter than normal that we ended up, I think, only around 10 inches behind the 30-year average for rainfall for Sitka. So, and it is interesting to think about, you know, that official drought classification is really based on normal, you know, deviation from normal. So we're still getting a lot of rain. And for Sitka, with sort of this massive bank of snow and ice in the mountains, the rainfall doesn't have as big an effect on our hydropower capacity. I know for some smaller communities where that's not the case, it can make, or other communities, not necessarily smaller communities, but other communities, that can make a much bigger difference, the year-to-year variation in how much hydropower is available. But the it did make me curious about, you know, these the plants, like how much is that causing stress to them, and, you know, like are there species that are going to, if that became a new normal, say, my guess is that it would, you know, some southern species would more easily get established here that like it a little bit warmer and a little bit drier. And maybe some other things.
And some of our local species might actually set seed more often.
They'd be happier.
You know, because they might actually be happier because they may tolerate these conditions really well and reproduce vegetatively more. Because most of our species here can reproduce by runners and things like that. Whereas seed set maybe is just something that happens when the weather's good. So they might have done better. And, you know, there still was a lot of moisture in the forest and a lot of moisture in the bogs. So I have a feeling that the plants were still doing fine. There were probably some conditions where things were drier. But I think most of our plants probably thought things were, like, weeha. And maybe that's why we have so many juncos. Part of my idea was like, geez, was it a really good year for fledglings? Was there more food around? Is that why we have such a big population of juncos this year? Because we had such a swanky summer.
Well, that's an interesting. Yeah, I noticed that I saw some of the biggest cranberries I've seen this year, and I suspected it was due to the warmth and sun. But the juncos, yeah, because there was I think the green alder sawflies were around, and the hemlock sawflies were around.
And those things on the currants, I can't remember.
Oh, right. Those
other sawfly things.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine the birds are eating those, especially when they're feeding young birds in the nest, feeding those insects. And so those could be helping out the bird populations, the songbird populations, for sure. Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that aspect of it, but it would make some sense. It's just... Yeah.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Yeah.
And we don't have any data really on how many birds actually.
Yeah.
But it was just, I wondered. It was like, okay, what's explaining all of these juncos I'm seeing around town or, you know, just around everywhere? But yeah, it was just an idea.
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, all these things end up being connected, it seems like, in various ways. So it is kind of fun to speculate and just have these. I guess I like to think of it as just keeping the questions in mind, not that there's any answers necessarily, but over time, you just picture stuff.
Nice to wonder about things.
And then if you...
Keeps our brains alive.
Right. And if you get really serious about it, you can either decide to do some actual data collection, structured data collection, or find somebody that needs a project to do and wants to do it. So, yeah, we have a little while left and want to talk a little bit about what's coming up in the next year. You know, is there, you brought a book in, I see.
And, I did bring a book in. And this is, again, it's like the time of year where I start teaching classes, and I teach natural history of Alaska in the spring semester. And one of the projects is that my students have to do a semester-long observation project. Actually, right now, I think all of my classes are doing observation projects. I'm kind of a dedicated nature watcher, so I want to inspire other folks to do that. But I bought this book a while ago that was recommended to me called The Law's Guide to Nature Drawing and Journaling. And it's written by John Muir Laws, hence the name. And it's super inspiring. Now, I've had this book for a year. This is a true confessions. And I haven't hardly used it yet. But it's gorgeous. So I was going to try to encourage myself for this year to actually make use of this book and use of some of the ideas in this book to kind of, stretch my edges with nature things. Now, I'm not going to produce a beautiful hand-drawn journal. at least not on a regular basis. I like to keep track of what I see and all that, but I would like to try to incorporate a little bit more of that in my regular day-to-day thing. So I wanted to kind of mention this book, and it's for people who would like to try drawing as a way to keep track of their nature things. I'd recommend this. It has very specific things on how to draw animals or how to draw wildflowers, how to draw landscapes, how to draw trees, on and on. But besides those little basic kind of drawing things, it also talks a lot about, you know, how to observe, and gives you kind of little inspiring little bits on how to do that. One of the things that was kind of fun was there was this chapter called Count, Estimate, Measure, and Time. And one of the things that attracted my attention in it was, what does 100 look like? So if you're counting birds for Christmas bird count, or you're counting birds for great backyard bird count, you're asked to give an estimate of numbers. And that is freaking challenging sometimes, counting all the little birds. If there's 5, great, you got that, right? 6. But when the numbers get big, all of us kind of underestimate usually, because it's hard. You're not going to count them, and you might try to count by tens. And but there's a little practice section in here where it gives you numbers of dots and tells you how many are there. And then so you kind of start training your eye. Anyway, there's lots of fun stuff like that in this book. So I'd recommend it.
Well, it does. I just kind of looking at it as you have it here, it does look like there's a lot of things of interest in there. It makes me think maybe I will get it and also not look at it for a while, because that seems to be the way that it goes.
Yeah,
with me.
And it isn't just about drawing. I don't want to say that. So like, here's a page I opened up to that says the little curiosity kit. So it's basically the kind of tools you might bring with you to kind of just have in a little satchel or something, very small satchel in your backpack when you're going out in the woods. It's things like a hand lens, a pocket knife, you know, what else do they have? Rulers. You probably have all this stuff.
I have most of that stuff.
They have a glue stick too. You probably don't have a glue stick.
I don't have a glue stick typically.
But you know, just so they call it the little curiosity kit, which I really like.
But I do carry containers, which they don't. Which they don't have there.
They have a viewing thing, but they just are kind of trying to get you outside, getting to look at things. You know, there's little prompts in here. There's all sorts of stuff, and of course the drawings in here are beautiful. And mine are never going to be this beautiful, but whatever. I do not have to compare myself to someone, but I'm gonna. My goal for this year is to maybe incorporate a little bit more of this into my day to day.
Yeah, I actually carry. Last year I adopted a vest. I got a fisherman's vest, which has a gazillion. It's just a mesh vest with It has like 10 pockets, but of various sizes. And so I put everything in that I want. A little KOH solution for lichens and fungi. That's, I have a little bit of
potassium
hydroxide. Yes, for I don't
just
know.
Just in
if
case
that,
you wanted to know what it was.
Yeah, I don't know if that makes it more sensible or not, but it is something that actually many fungi, and so lichens as well, that, will
right,
turn colors.
The color change
and
is
that
useful.
Is an indicator. So have that, hand lens. I carry lots of cameras, of course, but paper bags for things and little plastic containers for things. So it is, that's my little kit, among other things that I have. And I know a lot of people just go out and look, and they don't need or want a whole lot. It's just getting out to observe. And but I do find it is nice to have projects, I guess, to work on, so to speak, or just little edge stretching things. And for me, I have long been fixated on species, getting to know different species. And so I have a couple different ones that I'm looking to do. Well, one, I want to get through the backlog of photos. I am about halfway through, pretty much halfway through 2016. And then I have some cleanup to do from 2017. And I'll be all completely done with my backlog of photos to put into iNaturalist. I went all the way back through my even a couple of photos that were pre-digital scans of slides. I don't have too many of those. I know some others have put in a lot of those, but putting those into iNaturalist. And my total species count identified to species is about 1,940. It's 1,936, I think, right now. And so I am, one of my targets is to get to 2,000 identified to species things by the end of the year. I think that's pretty doable. I'm hoping to extend my streak of months where I add a new species. Now, the thing is, I didn't have to observe it in that month. It's when I added it. So as I'm going through the backlog, then there's things that get added then. Mm-hmm. However, once I get through that backlog, then it's going to be, I think that streak's going to end sometime in the next year or two, unless I'm like desperately digging out some lichens and bryophytes or something in the wintertime. It's just going to be too hard to get new stuff. But, and then I don't think I'll do this year, but I want to continue to work towards this year, which is my mega project, I guess, which is getting 1,000 species in a day. And that's probably the nerdiest thing I'll say today.
You made me roll my eyes.
My supportive friend here who's like, what, are you nuts? And yes, the answer is I am nuts. But for me,
it was a friendly eye roll.
Yes, for me, it is something that I have been, I don't know, curious about the possibility of. I don't know that I'm pretty sure it's possible, but I think it'll take actually quite as I've thought about it more, I think I'll actually literally have to have a fairly detailed plan for a bunch of the species to be like, okay, I need to get these plants and things here. Maybe even right down to the specific lichen on the tree. There's this lichen on this tree that I can get there. And so for me, that represents really kind of getting to know my neighborhood. Because probably a lot of it will happen within a relatively small area just because it costs too much in the way of time when you only have a day to do
it. Right, to move around.
Yeah, to move around, and you lose too much time doing that. So so that for me is just kind of a way that helps motivate me to get to know the neighborhood a little bit. And it was interesting that within a mile essentially of within a mile circle – roughly around Market Center, you know, if you centered it at Market Center or thereabouts and it put a mile circle in, there's been over 1,000 species observed in that. Now, a bunch of them are birds or fungi that are only there sometimes or insects that can be hard to find or only flying seasonally. So you can't really count on finding that many in any particular day, but it's like, oh, it's possible, you know. So, and there includes this beach there. So it is, yeah, that's an out there kind of stretch the edges thing, and it might take me several years to get to the point where I could actually do that. But that's one of the things
my goal feels
at.
Very small now. Just like want to draw some more, man. And
well, sometimes those are the hardest,
out.
Right?
Yeah. But one of the things I really like in this book is there's like little quotes in it too that I find inspirational. And actually, I might have to use this one in my class somehow, post it someplace. But this is good. This is kind of a nice intersection, maybe a little bit different than people think about science and natural history. But I like this one. And it's the most exciting phrase to hear in science, the one that heralds new discoveries, is not eureka, but that's funny.
Yes.
I love that. It's Isaac Asimov. But it's a great one because it really is like it really underscores the importance of paying attention to your world at whatever level. You know, you don't have to be like trying to discover some great new thing, but paying attention, you'll see things that get your brain excited.
And it is interesting that, for example, I was talking to somebody about this the other day. For a long time, my goal was to get 1,000 species in a year. And the first two times I tried, I didn't come anywhere close. And then I made it 1 year, and every year since then I have. The first time was the hardest time because it's just learning to see what's there in the first place and recognize it as something. And so there's been a number of times when that was essentially, you know, that quote encapsulates like, oh, there's this plant that for a long time I assumed was something. And then, but there's something different about it. And that's interesting. What is this? Mm-hmm. And then it turns out that it's something you didn't know about before. And for me, that is pretty exciting. I get excited when I get to discover new things. They're new to me, not usually new to science, but sometimes they are around here.
Yeah, you never know.
In some groups especially. Mm-hmm. I just posted some pictures of a leaf miner Columbine leaves. And I posted those and posted them online. And the guy who's literally writing the book on leaf miners in North America, he said, well, they're probably in this group, but there's nothing described from Alaska that looks like that. And so, you know, it could very well be an undescribed species of, of fly.
You basically can make new discoveries in fungi and insects in Southeast Alaska.
It's not that difficult.
No.
If you decide to look at those things. And it's, yeah, for me, in the end, it is really about, like, what you're describing, your interest in this book is just having reasons to get out and look around mm-hmm. and explore. And
look at things more carefully sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes that's what it is. It's like, you know, I've been looking at plants here for a really long time. And so you do start to kind of like, it's not necessarily like the green wall where you don't know what anything is.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, I know what that is. Whereas some cases I do actually need to like stick my nose in it and remember why I know what it is and make sure that I still know what it is because there's been taxonomic changes or whatever. So it's nice to dig back into things, to have the excuse to dig back into things.
That is one thing I find going through old pictures is I'll see, I called this something. I wonder why. You know, I don't actually remember. Sometimes it's because I got a name from somebody else. Sometimes it's because that's what I figured out what it was at the time, but am no longer remembering that very well. So it is kind of thing. And for me personally, those numbers things, like that's motivational to me. And it isn't to everybody. It's ridiculous to a lot of people. It's like, what? That is nuts. And I agree, it is nuts. But it's my kind of nuts, right? It's
whatever gets you out there.
What motivates me. And for a lot of people, it's different things. Some people are really into birds. I like birds. But other people are out every day looking at birds, mm-hmm. you know, checking birds out. And I like everything. So it is really, you know, finding what works for you, finding what's inspiring for you and getting out there and exploring. And maybe that's just gardening, you know, for a lot of people they like to get out and garden and over time
you see
a lot of stuff
because you're in your spot. And sometimes for me, I'm very kinetic. I like jump around and move around all the time. So for me, when I make, actually it's a challenge for me making myself sit still and actually watch something or draw something. And so what I've been doing lately is with my second cup of coffee of the day, watching all the birds outside my feeder and looking for bands and just looking at the birds. And one thing I noticed from all these thrushes being around, just because I'm sitting still and looking, was like, oh, golly, their feet are almost the same color as their orange chest, mm-hmm. which hadn't, you know, I'm always like I look at a buried thrush. It's like, oh, yeah, it's a buried thrush. But I wasn't seeing it in that detail until I held still and actually looked at it. So I would encourage you to hold still and look.
Yeah, that is one of the fascinating things about drawing. I was listening to a podcast and they were talking a little bit about like perspective in art. That was something that didn't come easy. But once it was there and taught, then it became obvious to people in some ways. And it was this idea that which they teach you in drawing is that so often you're drawing what you know that you see rather than what you actually see. So you have this mental model of oh, I know that's a varied thrush, and you don't actually look at it anymore. It's just that there's mm-hmm. that there. And so it's taking that time to really like
to actually look at it. Yeah, it was cool. It's bright orange yellow feet. And today I was like, oh, that one really has a really white belly below that orange breast. And I hadn't really paid any attention to that either. So someday I'll really know that varied thrush and I'll be able to actually describe it well and not just say, you know, it's the orange. It's like a robin sized bird with orange and a black band around its chest.
Yeah.
It's like, yep, that's a varied thrush. But I'm spending a little more time looking at them.
Well, we have wound up our hour here, so I want to thank you for coming in and chatting with me about the past year and the coming year. No doubt we'll have you back in at some point in the near future. Not too distant future, I guess I should say.
There you go.
I know there's some natural history seminars coming up and in the works.
I'm working on them.
So, yeah, keep an eye out for those in the usual announcement places, newspaper, radio. So thank
email
you.
Email list.
Yeah, email list. If you're not already joined there, you can email me sitkanature@gmail.com and request to be added to the Natural History Seminar Series list. But yeah, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show with my guest Kitty Labowney. We are recording this Saturday, the day before this is airing. So thank you for joining us here, listening on Raven Radio. As always, if you want to hear recordings of past shows, you can go to sitkanature.org/raven and find the archive there. I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to email me, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.